Let's name some things that Christians do that seem weird to people who aren't Christians. Name some things that Christians do that seem weird to people who aren't Christians. Okay. Pray. Yeah, there you go. Who are you talking to anyway? Yeah. Yeah. What else? I think you phrased that great. Okay, put other people. Yeah, you've got to watch out for number one, right? Yeah, put other people before yourselves. That really kind of gets to the essence of a lot, I think, right there.
Love your enemies.
Love your enemies. Yeah, I remember coming across that one time, and I wanted to skip that part. Yeah.
It comes up that you've heard it was.
Yes.
Yes,
no, exactly. And you can see that sounds weird in Jesus' context as well. Yeah, exactly.
Sometimes it's
on
anxiety level. Anxiety
level?
Yeah, sometimes anxiety level because, you know, I've seen situations particularly at work where something's going on in the world that's, like, really disturbing.
Uh-huh.
And they're like, so why aren't you all upset?
Yeah. Why aren't you as anxious about this as everybody else? Yeah. That's good example. David?
I was just thinking, just our use of money.
Yes.
In other words, it's not the almighty dollar is not really almighty.
No, far from it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Why are you indifferent to the thing that's most important to me? Yeah, that's very true. This is great. I appreciate this. A lot. Yeah, go. Tithing. Yeah. Why do you give so much away? It's interesting, even in a time when we have lots of questions, many people have lots of questions about, you know, is anybody taking the Christian faith seriously? You look at, carefully developed statistical data, it shows that people with religious commitments in the United States, who are predominantly Christian, of course, they give more of their money away than other people do. It's also interesting that as a percentage, people of lower economic resources tend to give more than people of higher economic resources. So anyway, this is really helpful. I had a perfect agenda set up, and then Becca ruined everything last week. I'm going to spend a couple of weeks just trying to get caught up a little bit. So it's. I'm sorry. Well, that part, you know, it's great to have a big file of old sermons, just in terms of what we're doing, we'll spend a little less time on some things than we might have otherwise, but I hope we still get a clear picture of some things. Anyway, we're going to continue talking about Paul and look at some of Paul's letters in overview today. One of the things that I hope will be the case by the time we're done with everything that we're doing is that you should be able to say, okay, I don't know everything that's in this letter, but I know the main idea in the whole letter. Just have kind of a central concept for each one, or in some cases for pairs or groups of them where they go together. So anyway, when Doug came down and called the reserve quarterback off the bench, we were talking about Paul's life, and I know I had drawn a map. And I've been practicing all week, so let's see if it's any better. No, it's really not. Okay. And we said that Paul was born in Tarsus to a Jewish family in a Roman military colony where people would have spoken Greek predominantly as the language all the time. So he probably grew up in this Greek-speaking environment, what historians would call a Hellenistic environment, meaning even though we're not in Greece proper, it's culturally Greek. But then as a boy, maybe a pre-adolescent, maybe as young as 8 or 10, but probably no older than about 12. He moved to Jerusalem, where he studied with teachers of the law among the Pharisees. Now here he would have picked up another language, and he and Acts shows us that he's using both of these languages, that he was able to speak the Aramaic language, which was the language of the Jewish people in their heartland. The language of the people of Israel in the Old Testament was Hebrew, but during the time of the Babylonian exile, that language was basically fell out of use as a conversational language, and they picked up the language of the Babylonians, which was Aramaic, and brought that back with them. But when Alexander the Great swept through this region, he brought the Greek language and Greek culture, but the Aramaic language persisted as the primary language in this region. If you were from this region and spoke Aramaic, that was a badge of honor. That meant you are a true Israelite, a Hebrew of the Hebrews. Exactly. Yeah. Well, and it's impossible to know exactly. This is what we infer from what we can read in contemporary sources just about how this kind of education was done. So you know, there would have been a kind of a basic, commonly, there would have been a basic education in the scriptures of Israel for a Jewish boy.
Do you think the families might take them under their wing?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you don't just kind of arrive, you know, with a tag, you know, on you, like, you know, those stories about the kids leaving London during the Blitz and going out, you know, they just put them on a train with a tag and then they show up at a train station and someone, you know, picks them up. Yeah, I think they would have been probably hosted by families. This may be something that's arranged with relatives, you know, something of that nature. But if you were bright and talented, they got you early, and you begin this. From a completely different perspective, it's important that we not kind of read later things into the past, but have any of you read The Chosen by Chaim Potok? Okay, you know that book? Yeah. It's a beautiful book. It's amazing. Tragic, makes you laugh, it makes you cry, all of those things. It's a story of two adolescent boys in a Hasidic Jewish community in New York. And they're both brilliant, but one of them is exceptionally brilliant, and he's the son of the rabbi. And he's expected to sit at the table and study Torah and study the teachings of the rabbis for hours a day when he's, you know, very young, and to commit those kind of things to memory. Probably not as formalized and rigorous as all of that for everyone at the time, but there's probably something like that going on. So he's got this experience. The rabbis that, as I said, that he studied with were rabbis among the Pharisees. Now, I know you're taking notes and remembering everything that I say. The Pharisees, of course, are a religious sect of Judaism in this period who are reacting to contemporary events and asking themselves the question, what can we do in light of our situation? Our situation is we are in exile. And what do we do about that? How should we live under exile? And their answer is keep the law carefully and meticulously, because, of course, we're in exile because we didn't keep the law. So that seems logical. We should keep the law. How are you going to keep the law? You build a fence around it. So you surround the law with regulations and traditions which come out of your reasoning and your observations. And if you follow those things, you will not violate the commandments. Now, we do this kind of thing sometimes in American evangelical culture. Maybe you've heard people use the phrase the Billy Graham rule, which means, you know, if you're a man, you shouldn't, you know, like go out to lunch with a woman by yourself, or be alone with a woman that you're not married to, something like that. Graham did that because that way no one could accuse him of anything. But some people do that because then you're kind of two steps away from any monkey business. Okay, well, that can be kind of an example of fencing the law. And I offer that without comment or judgment as to whether that's a good idea or a bad idea. That's what the Pharisees did. Well, there were two. Of course, once you start something, people always start splitting up over it, right? Okay, you wonder how this happens. There were two schools of Pharisees. One was the school of Hillel, and the other was the school of Shammai. So it's impossible to say that any Pharisees weren't strict, but these were the less strict guys, and these were the more strict guys. Okay, and this could be illustrated, for example, in the way that they approached divorce, which was a big controversy in the time of in Judaism in this period, primarily because the Mosaic Law didn't give the Pharisees all the information they needed to do their Pharisee thing about this. So the school of Hillel said a husband can divorce a wife for any reason. If she's displeasing to him, it's okay to divorce her. This is what Jesus is criticizing when he says you cannot divorce your wife for any cause. Okay, it's this any cause divorce that he's addressing. School of Shammai said, nope, only for sexual immorality. That's the only reason. So that's kind of an indication of the contrast. Hillel's son-in-law was a guy named Gamaliel. He appears briefly in the book of Acts in chapter 5, and later in Acts, when Paul is describing his life, he says this is who he studied with. Okay, so he's over here, but this is what is interesting. Paul also says, as in his letters, as he is discussing his former life, he says, as to zeal for the law, he was unsurpassed. He was the number one zealous guy in his time. Now, what does he mean by that? Well, this has been famously summarized by a New Testament scholar that I have learned a ton from, N.T. Wright, who said, in Paul's time, zeal is something you do with a knife. Okay. This means you are willing to put people to death for the sake of the law. Okay. So what that suggests is that after studying over here, Saul, also known as Paul, he seems to have kind of made the ideological move over here, that he really probably more closely aligned with the stricter group because of this expression of zeal that he talks about. And this is, of course, what we see when we are introduced to him in the book of Acts. But what happens to him is that on the Damascus Road, the risen Lord Jesus appears to him. And Paul understands that, and the book of Acts presents it, not just as an internal vision, but as the physical appearance of Jesus in the same way that he appeared to his disciples in the 40 days after his resurrection. Okay. Yes, yeah, it's very interesting in Acts because he hears the voice that says, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? That's kind of fun too, because in the Gospels, Jesus often uses double words of address. Martha, Martha, you are troubled with many things. You know, things of that nature. And then here you hear the same thing of the risen Jesus. You know, it's just, and that's not the kind of thing someone would make up. You know, it's just the kind of incidental thing that would be there and be remembered. Why do you persecute me? And he asks this question of perplexity, because he knows what he's doing. He's serving God. He's going to Damascus to arrest Christians because they're blasphemers and they should be arrested. How could I be I know this must be the voice of God, but how could I be persecuting? So he says, who are you? And then he answers his own question. Who are you, Lord? So he's in that state of perplexity. This has got to be the Lord, but how can it be the Lord? And the answer is, I am Jesus. There you are. Okay, it all comes together at that point. So this is the turning point in his life. He goes to Damascus. Ananias is sent to him. He is baptized. He's temporarily blinded, which is kind of a an object lesson for the condition that he's been in. You know, he has been blind to what God is doing, but now his sight is restored. And instead of arresting Christians, he starts doing the things that he wants to arrest Christians for. And so we have this turnaround. And so later, Paul in his letters again can say, I am a Hebrew of the Hebrews. I'm from the heartland. I speak the heartland language. As to zeal for the law, unsurpassed. Okay? No one could complain about the way that I kept the law. But I regard all of that as skubalon in Greek, which means rubbish or sewage. Okay, I regard that as nothing for the sake of knowing Jesus. So this is the defining moment of Paul's life. How is it that Paul comes to understand himself as an apostle? He says, I'm a witness of the resurrection of Jesus. He has a whole vocabulary, as people did in his time, for describing visionary experiences. And he says that he's had visions. But what happened on Damascus Road was not a vision. It was a resurrection appearance. It was a physical appearance. And so he says, I've seen the Lord Jesus raised in 1 Corinthians like someone born at the wrong time, like a child born after a 3-year pregnancy, which is a terrible thought, that this has happened. And so his life is transformed out of that, and he becomes, of course, a missionary pastor theologian, really, in all of this. When we read the New Testament, we often think of Paul as laying out Christian doctrine. And he is, but he's doing it as a missionary and a pastor. He is responding to what's going on in people's lives, and he is applying the gospel to that actively. So there's always a concern about how people are understanding themselves and how they're living in everything that he says. And we understand his letters better when we think of them as, okay, this is responding to a situation. There's a situation here on the ground. And all of this makes a lot more sense if we understand how that works. How would we describe this guy? Rabbi? Yes. When does he stop being a rabbi? Never. You know, he's always a teacher of the law of Israel. But as a follower of Jesus, he sees Jesus as the fulfillment of what God has promised. He is a follower of Jesus, and he will always be aligning himself and encouraging those that he's writing to and preaching to align themselves with the story of Jesus. Okay. Yes. Yes. Yes, this is very important. Aligning with Jesus as the fulfillment of God's promises, and understanding central to God's promises is the promise that through Abraham, God will bless all the nations. Okay, if you've been with us the whole time, you'll recall that at the beginning, I tried to set up this kind of... leave your phone right there so I can see what time it is, too. That's great. No, it doesn't even have... Yeah, I can read it upside down. That's good. It's just like being up on upstairs. You've got the thing that tells you how much time you have left. Brian and I regularly blow through that, by the way. That we've got this kind of essential tension in the Old Testament. God is the creator of everything. And he's only worshipped by this one little, tiny, poor, insignificant nation. And they don't do it very well. You know, so how can that be? And the answer is, as he says, I'm going to make myself known to everybody. I'm going to make myself known to the nations. I'm going to take my world back. Okay. And so Paul is saying this is being fulfilled. And he understands it's being fulfilled in a way that says, and this is the consistent vision of the New Testament. And I think it tells us a lot about how we need to be the church in any place, in any age. God is making the nations his, not by having everyone adopt one culture, but by transforming people in whatever cultural setting they are in. So if you are a Jew, you remain a Jew, but you become a follower of Jesus, and you understand that you belong to the people of God, not because you have Abraham as your father, but because you acknowledge Jesus as Lord. If you are a Gentile, you know, we've always been welcome. As a Jewish person in the first century, you probably believe that God is going to bless the nations because you've read that more than once. Okay. But you assume, naturally, he's going to bless the nations by making them all one of us. Okay. So they will join with us and become like us, and we will be one people of God. And then the gospel breaks in, and we've got the Ethiopian eunuch, and we've got Cornelius, and none of these people are being told, wait, you've got to become Jewish, and in particular, how do you begin being Jewish? Circumcision. Yeah. No, you don't have to do that. Well, that's not just saying you can avoid a painful, you know, and awkward outpatient surgery, you don't have to conform culturally to Jewish culture, okay? This is where we realize the law of Israel was very much a kind of a mixed bag of things, okay? All given by God, but given to Israel for various reasons. Some of it reflects what is always right, always wrong. You shall not murder, okay? That's a rule, okay? And why is it? Because human beings bear the image of God. That was a rule before Moses made it a rule, right? But let's take a different example. Don't eat animals if they don't cleave the hoof and chew the cud, which basically leaves out pigs, which is very unfortunate, okay? Because pigs take anything and turn it into delicious barbecue. So they should be enjoyed, and we should give thanks for that. Well, why no pig? Why no shellfish? You know, etc. Those were national ethnic boundary markers. Okay, in the same way that food is always important to culture, Israel is given clean and unclean as a way of saying this is who you are. So you've got laws of clean and unclean, especially about food. You've got laws about the calendar. Calendar is very important to culture, what you do on particular days. Food, calendar, and the regulations of the temple. Those were all things which are given to Israel. The nations are welcome to participate in those things. You're supposed to invite your non-Israelite neighbors to join you in Passover, for example. But Passover is Israel's feast, all right? Now, what is the gospel saying? God is blessing the nations. He takes them as they are, and he lets them be the people that they are. So are you a Jew? You're still a Jew. Are you a Greek? You're still a Greek. But there's no longer Jew or Greek, slave or free, male or female, because the significance of the distinctions is obliterated. You are who you are, and you come to this thing, and you belong to it as you are. That now is a load of work, because it is very difficult for people of different cultures to live together, okay, as we see all around us every day, all the time. There would 80% of the New Testament wouldn't exist if it weren't for this problem. Much of it is being written to this problem, and a lot of what Paul is writing about is addressing this very thing. It's either the problem of figuring out how to live out the implications of the gospel in general in a world where those things are weird, or it is the difficulty of getting along with one another as people of different cultural and social backgrounds and living together as family. So, yeah, Paul is uniquely prepared to be a missionary to both groups because he is familiar with the Hellenistic world, but thoroughly Jewish at the same time. And under this profound, zealous conviction, through having witnessed the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, that this is what God is doing in the world. And this is how... Yes. Yeah, this, well, in Romans,
right,
chapters 9 to 11, he's saying, you know, I would give my own life if my countrymen would come to faith in Jesus. Now, he also makes the point a little later in that passage, don't think that some of us haven't. A lot of us have. We often, as people who probably identify as Gentile Christians, we often imagine Jewish people didn't believe in Jesus. Stop for a minute and remember, all of your heroes in the New Testament are Jews. Okay. Jewish Christians really dominated the church in the first generation. There were lots of Gentile converts, but there were lots of Jewish converts too. When Paul gets back to Jerusalem in Acts chapter 21, James says to him, we have tens of thousands of believers who are zealous for the law. And he's using the biggest common number word that you use in the Greek language. This would be the equivalent of somebody saying zillions, okay, which is a made-up number for, you know, lots. I like to, students in colleges like the ones that I've taught in often are there because they hate math and they know they won't have to take much at a college with a heavy biblical studies curriculum. So I would ask them questions like, you know, what's 10 zillion divided by 2 zillion? You know, and if they could answer that, I knew that they could think mathematically. Whether you're right, it was like they just dropped my class at that stage, which was also a strategy. So, when I would talk about the parable of the prodigal son, talk about the division of inheritance, I'd say this is how you divided an inheritance in the Jewish world. Take the number of, let's let N represent the number of sons a father had. And at that point, I would hear massive groans through the whole room. It's like, oh, I don't want to do algebra, Dr. Weatherly. But so now take N plus 1, you divide the estate into that many parts, and everyone gets one share, but the oldest son gets two shares. And this actually happened one time. There's a pause, and somebody says, that works no matter how many sons there are. And I said, welcome to algebra. Okay, you see, this is the first time you've used it since high school, but it's worthwhile. Okay. This is why we'll never get through to the end, because I'm going to tell all these dumb stories. So he's very, very Jewish, but very committed to this inclusion of people who aren't Jewish. And very committed in some of what we'll hopefully talk about today, to making sure that people live together in a way that expresses... well, what we were talking about before, putting others before yourself, caring more about what other people care about than what you care about. And the specific instance of this is in 1 Corinthians, where in chapters 8 to 10, Paul is discussing a food question. There is food available in the city of Corinth that you can buy at the marketplace that came from animals that had been sacrificed to pagan idols. Should you eat that? It's a question of clean and unclean. And it probably divided, to a certain extent, Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians, but it may have kind of cut across both ways. Because on the one hand, you can say, you know, an idol is nothing. This is just meat. God made this animal. I think we should cook it and eat it. And on the other hand, wait a minute, that's an idol. That's an offense to the living God. I want nothing to do with anything that's associated with that. There's the division. Well, what Paul says is, follow the other guy's rules. Okay? If you have someone at your table, respect that person's rules. Serve what they will eat. If you are at someone else's table, don't ask any questions about the food. Okay. And that's how we get along. What is that saying? I care more about my sister or brother than I care about my view of this thing. What a revolutionary concept, you know. Yes, yeah, and he says, this is the context in which he says, among the Jews I live as a Jew, among the Greeks I live as a Greek. I become all things to all people, you know. Culturally, I go with the flow, okay. Now, are there things that Paul won't do? Yeah, he is following Jesus. But he knows the difference between commandment and culture, and he is readily adaptable to all of that. Yeah, this captures a lot of what Paul is talking about. So some of his letters are written to people who are saying, my group is better than your group. And the design of those letters is to say, no, you're all terrible, that we all are here because of the grace of Jesus. And when we understand that, then we can accept one another more readily. That's the insight. Yeah, that's good stuff. All right, let's talk a little bit about how Paul's letters are put together. And this is simple, so we can do this pretty quick, I think, I hope. Paul's letters follow the standard form of letters in the Greco-Roman world. And how do we know this? We have lots of letters from the Greco-Roman world. Some people publish their letters. Now, publishing looks different before the invention of printing. It really means that people attach value to what you have written, and so the rich people spend great amounts of money to have it copied, mostly so that they can use it in the education of their children, especially their sons. So this is stuff that I want my sons to read and learn from. So how would we have, say, the Iliad and the Odyssey of Homer, or the works of Aristotle, or the Aeneid of Virgil, or something like that? That's all material that rich guys wanted their sons to learn. And so that and they wanted to be able to continue to read themselves to understand, so that they could maintain their rich status. The Jewish people had their scriptures copied for an adjacent but similar reason. This is instruction for all of us. And in some cases, people's letters were regarded as so instructive that they were copied out and preserved in that way. But more often, archaeologists have found places, especially in Egypt, where there are documents that were just thrown away, but they've been preserved. The nice thing about Egypt is that it's dry and sandy. And so there are places where we literally have excavated Greco-Roman garbage dumps in Egypt and have found letters. And what we discover is that they follow pretty much the same pattern. There's, first of all, a salutation. So this would be the kind of thing that you have in Paul's letters, where he says, I'm Paul and you're you. Okay, Paul to the church at Thessalonica, the church at Corinth. That's the salutation. And typically in those letters, you would have a word of greeting, which in Greek was pronounced kyrene or kyrene, depending on which convention of modern pronunciation of ancient Greek you use, which was greetings. Well, Paul begins his letters not with kyrene, but with charis, which is the word for grace. So it's a play on words. Now, in Jewish circles, the word of greeting is shalom in Hebrew, meaning peace. And that's understood not just as a word of greeting, but really as a prayer. You know, it's a prayer for peace for someone else. Paul translates that with the Greek word for peace, Irene. If you know anyone named Irene, she's probably very peaceful and placid, because it's derived from that. So he says grace and peace. Interesting. Okay, there's a play on words there, which is directing us to the grace of God. He is using the Hebrew greeting, and not just a prayer, but a prayer which we now see being fulfilled. And that actually builds probably off of some of what Jesus said when Jesus sends the 12 out to preach. He says, when you go to a house, give it your peace. And if they receive you, your peace remains. But if you don't, your peace returns to you. In other words, he's saying, you go and wish them shalom, but you actually bring shalom. If they receive you, they receive the shalom. If not, you can take it to the next place. Okay, you're not going to run out of shalom. So he's kind of building on that. But then you see, you know, he's bringing these two sides of the culture together too, the Jewish side, the Greek side, all kind of happening there. So in the salutation, Paul is not just doing something formal, but he's saying stuff that is important. From the salutation, you typically go to a thanksgiving. A typical letter's thanksgiving would just say something like, I thank the gods that you are healthy and prosperous, as am I. And it's just sort of a common pro forma thing, a nod to God, if you will, or a nod to a God. Paul uses thanksgivings in all of his letters except Galatians. In Galatians, he omits the thanksgiving, which is kind of like walking into somebody's house without knocking. It's saying, I want to get your attention. Okay, that happened to me one time when I was 16. There was family that lived up the street. They had a daughter who was a couple years older than I was. I thought she was kind of cute, kind of fun. You know, hoped that she would show some interest in me, even though I was 2 years younger, which is like an eternity when you're a teenager. And one day, I'm sitting in the living room, and she walks up the walk, and I thought, oh, Barb came over. And then she just threw open the door. I thought, wow, she's really interested. And she said, our house is on fire. Yeah, it was. Okay, everybody was fine. You know, if you've got an old freezer in the garage, though, check it from time to time. Yeah, that was getting our attention. So Paul omits the thanksgiving in Galatians, but in his other letters he includes it. And again, he doesn't just do this in a pro forma way. If you read the thanksgiving sections of Paul's letters carefully, you hear the themes that the rest of the letter is going to develop. Paul would get an A in English Comp 101. Okay, he always writes with a thesis. Occasionally, you'd say, I wish you'd be a little clearer here. You might write that in the margin, but he's always writing with a thesis. From there, we have the letter body, which is what the letter is really about. Now, sometimes in Paul's letters, the letter body divides neatly between kind of theory and practice, what we believe and how we put it into practice. I think Ephesians is the letter that does that most obviously. Because you have chapters 1 to 3, and then at the beginning of chapter 4, Paul says, we need to walk worthily of the calling with which we have been called. In other words, let's now put this into practice. Sometimes he does that, but not every time. Not every time. But there's always something that goes just beyond the cognitive, beyond the theoretical in what Paul writes in the letter body. The fourth section of a letter is then the closing greetings. And this is where a letter writer will say, there are some people who are with me who want to send greetings to you, and I want to send greetings to some people who are with you. So just an exchange of relationship information in all of that. Very interesting that in Paul's letters, the letters that has the most closing greetings is his letter to the Romans, and he's never been to Rome. But he seems to know everybody there anyway. Okay? And the letter that has no closing greetings is Ephesians. And Paul spent about 2 years in Ephesus on his third missionary journey. There's a peculiar reason for that, which I will just dangle out there as something that we might talk about later, if we get the chance. So let's briefly talk about two of the earliest letters of Paul, which also are short. and should make it make for easy conversation. I was hoping to get to a little bit of 1 and 2 Corinthians today too, but I don't think we'll have too much time for that. Let's talk about 1 and 2 Thessalonians. If you put New Testament scholars together and say which is the earliest letter of Paul, you'll get a good discussion going. A lot of people will say Galatians, including me, but many people will say 1 and 2 Thessalonians. I think that it is Galatians that's the earliest, but I want to talk about Galatians more in a couple of weeks when we talk about Romans. Let's use 1 and 2 Thessalonians, though, as an example, not just because they're early, but also because they're good examples of what we're talking about. First of all, there is a situation to which Paul is writing in these two letters. And the situation mostly has to do with the fact that Paul had to leave Thessalonica in a hurry. Okay, Thessalonica is an interesting city. It's in Macedonia in Greece, the northern part of Greece. It was the leading city in Macedonia. It was a harbor town, which meant there's a busy port there. And so it has all of the economic and cultural features that you would find in a place like that. There's a lot of money changing hands, but there are a lot of people needed in that period of history to load and unload ships by hand. So lots of manual laborers who would work all day, be paid at the end of the day so they could go and buy food. It was also a place that it was like any place in the Greco-Roman world. It was dominated by pagan religion. And a part of that pagan religion was involved what is, from a Jewish point of view or a Christian point of view, extremely immoral. It involved temple prostitution. So that's going on. Paul, according to Acts, had to leave Thessalonica because of persecution, which was focused primarily on him. And so rather than cause the church more trouble, he goes on to the next place. And so it was probably only there a matter of a few months. Imagine becoming a Christian, and the only guy you know who really knows the faith is only there a few months and has to leave. Okay. Now, part of the problem here is televangelists. Wait, they didn't have television. No, they didn't. But you don't need television to have this problem. Okay. There's a lot of literature from the Greco-Roman world that says traveling, dishonest religious and philosophical teachers were a feature of ancient life. Okay, 52 sermons and a fast car, as people said when I was growing up. Okay, you're at a church long enough to just take advantage of them, and then you're off to the next place. Those guys, and we're talking out of every cultural and religious background. So what does it look like when this guy shows up and says, a crucified man is now king, this changes everything, and then he's gone in a couple of months? What do people think? He's another one of those guys.
Sure.
Yeah, exactly. And what are your friends telling you? Because to your friends, you are now officially weird in all the ways that we just described. Okay, they're saying, you can stop being weird. This guy was taking advantage of you. So the first thing that Paul does in this letter, he does in 1 Thessalonians for the first three chapters, he tells them, remember what I was like when I was with you. And remember why you bought into this thing. Why it was that you went with this. You realize that with this, you came in touch with the living God. Okay. And how did we live among you? I didn't take any money from any of you. I worked day and night. And this is where we see Paul, the tent maker. Paul has a craft. And we know what that was like. A tent maker was someone who made things out of leather and heavy canvas, and not just tents, but other useful things like bags and things of that nature. I always imagine the first thing that Paul did as a tent maker was buy some leather and make a bag for his tools. You know, so he could carry him from one place to another. So Paul would go into a town and just set up shop in the marketplace and make useful things so that he didn't have to take any money from the people to whom he was preaching. Now, he did receive gifts later when he went on to the next place. But he insisted, I was not a burden to any of you. And why does he do this? He says, this is the love of God. This is the way the love of God works. Okay, and so he's reminding them of that. And what's what I find so interesting about that is that he's not just saying, this is what I did so that I wouldn't be a burden to you. He's saying, this is what I did because this is what it means to follow Jesus. You're generous beyond the point of requirement. The love just flows out of you. And he's providing an example to them. Now, let me, real quick, because time's a-wasting. Too many jokes today. Let's imagine what it's like to shift from this to this, if you're Jewish. Okay, we've been talking about this. This is a way of thinking about the reign of God, the kingdom of God coming into the world. As a person of Jewish faith, I've been expecting God to act, and that's just going to change everything. But what the gospel does is change everything while this present evil age continues until Jesus returns. That's a huge shift if you're Jewish. It's an even bigger shift if you're a Greek, because you don't even think that God's going to do anything. So it's not surprising that in the Thessalonian letters that we see people struggling with the future. What does the present mean versus the future? So in chapter 4, Paul says, okay, concerning those who have fallen asleep, which he uses as a euphemism for death, I do not want you to be ignorant. We don't want you to grieve like people who have no hope. Now, and to say in light of what I talked about last week, he's not saying don't grieve at all. He's saying grieve hopefully. And why is that? Because he says God does not abandon his people. So yes, now we are separated from those who have died, but when the Lord returns, he brings them with him, and we will meet them, and so we will be with the Lord forever. Therefore, comfort one another with these words. Okay. So he's saying, understand what's going on here. Death is not the end for any of us, and not just for us, but for us together. God is bringing his family back together in this way, because this is his intention. And in 2 Thessalonians, he's talking to people who are worried, well, maybe God is done. You know, and he says, no, don't listen to anybody who says the day of the Lord has already come. Because until the enemy is completely defeated, God is not done. Okay, that's a real quick summary of 12 of the hardest verses of the New Testament. But the emphasis here is, think in these terms. There's another thing about Thessalonian letters that maybe we can talk about. I'm not preaching. Real quickly. Okay, you're going to have to go straight up to worship. There's also a problem of people taking advantage of Christians' generosity. Okay, why do they do that? Well, in a culture like Thessalonica, where there are lots of laborers, but also lots of rich people, if you can't get work for the day, you go to a rich guy, and he will be your patron, and you will be his client, and he will give you money so that you can live, and in turn, you will walk behind him in the marketplace and tell everybody how great he is. And things of that nature. Well, in that cultural context, people are kind of making the move of that into the setting of Christian generosity and taking what they think of as patronage money from other Christians. And Paul says in 2 Thessalonians, if people won't work, they shouldn't eat, because everyone should have the dignity of work if they are able. It's amazing, though, how right after he says that, he says, but don't get tired of doing good. Okay. In other words, you're going to be taken advantage of. So is Jesus. Okay. Keep on keeping on. You know, better to be generous than to act as if none of this thing matters. But understand that bigger picture. That's telling us to leave. That is telling us to leave. Okay, I'm going to shut up now. We're all going to go upstairs and worship Jesus. Thank you very much. You know, exactly. That's why they call them smartwatches, right? Smartphone, smartwatch. We're all good. Thank you very much, you